Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. All upcoming professional development offerings are listed on our webpage, nysrti.org. The copy of today's PowerPoint and handouts are available on the webpage, and I put the link in the chat box for you. During today's presentation, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's presentation, we will post a link to a brief evaluation. We are very pleased to have Dr. Catherine Stahl with us today to present our third webinar in the Strand 17 series, Fostering Reading Comprehension for Children in Grade 3 to Grade 6 at Tier 1 or Core Instruction. Today's topic is Developing Skilled Expression of Reading Comprehension, the Importance of Discussion and Writing. Dr. Catherine Stahl is a clinical professor of literacy at New York University. Dr. Stahl studies the effective instruction of reading in the elementary years. She is committed to improving student achievement and school effectiveness, especially in urban settings. She is currently the director of the NYU Literacy Clinic. For over 25 years, Stahl taught in high-poverty public elementary and middle school classrooms. The questions that she researches stem from these experiences and from current classroom observations. Her research examines reading acquisition and reading comprehension. Dr. Stahl has written 5 books related to literacy instruction. She earned her Ed.D. in reading education from the University of Georgia in 2003. Welcome, Dr. Stahl.
Thank you, Dane, and welcome back, friends. So today we are going to be talking about the importance of discussion and writing, and we'll also be talking a little bit about some of your experiences in trying some of the ideas that we addressed in our part one and part two of this webinar strand. So if you would let me know what role you play in your school using our poll. There we go. Okay, great. All right, so now we're ready to go to the next one. And I imagine you all work with all grades. What grade levels? Yeah, exactly, since we have a special educator and a district administrator. And then our next poll is regarding the attendance, and I think I already know the answer to this one. Now, these names are very familiar. That's, I thought that some of you, yeah. Okay. Dan, I wonder if you could, on my right side, I'm still seeing those roles, if you could eliminate those or make them smaller. Yeah, this far right where it says getting acquainted, because what it's doing, it's blocking my, it's actually blocking my view of the chat. And we're going to be doing a lot of chatting today. So our agenda today is to review the goals and reflections based on our last two webinars in this series. It's also, then we're going to move on to some new material, which is we're going to look at some research-based discussion protocols to help students expand and express their comprehension. And then we're going to look at some research-based writing instructional techniques to help students expand and express comprehension. And because it's really impossible to separate the expression of comprehension from comprehension alone, because the only artifacts we have to know what someone has understood are their words in both language, oral language, as well as their written word. And additionally, by discussing what we've read with others, it helps us actually expand our own comprehension by bringing in different viewpoints, by bringing in additional information that we may not have privy to. And the same thing with the writing, by needing to articulate what our thoughts are, it really forces us and expands our own comprehension. So these two abilities have to be embedded with our comprehension instruction. Okay, now for those of you who were with us last time, I had asked you to select two comprehension strategies and then to use figure 9.3 of your article of comprehension is not a not your grandfather's or your father's Oldsmobile to record your decision making in how you were teaching comprehension strategies. And you chose some strategies that were a good match for your curriculum. So that was our goal when we met 2 weeks ago. And those of you who were administrators were going to observe three ELA lessons and use figure 9.3 to identify what forms of interaction across the gradual release of responsibility were being used in those classrooms that you were observing. So let's activate your chat box, and it's great that we do have a small group today. So if you have been with us, and I noticed that one of you had been with us for all of our the first two webinars, so talk to me about what strategies you tried, using your new information, and where. How you released the responsibility to your students? Did you follow the explicit strategy instruction model and then model it and then enable your children to use it in a collaborative format within guided practice before engaging in independent use? If you're an administrator, even if you were not here before, basically when you've been in classrooms observing comprehension instruction, What format does that take? Is it done in whole group with teachers explicitly teaching kids how to process text? Or is it more them just asking questions and testing kids, which is what Dolores Durkin found many years ago? So let's use this opportunity to share some of your experience with what you observe and what you have done recently in applying the comprehension strategies with your students and in classrooms you've observed. And for the person who's new, you can actually type in that chat box and I'll be able to see it. You don't have the opportunity to have verbal interaction with me, but it's through the typing in your chat box that it appears for all of us to see and for all of us to discuss and for us to discuss and interact regarding. And I saw that Diane was typing, but I'm not seeing it appear in my chat box. Did you type something, Diane, that's just simply not appearing or have a change of heart? Good. I'm seeing everyone participate. I like that. Okay. So Diane is saying that not in the classroom. During her observation of walkthroughs, she saw more of that assessment that Dolores Durkin saw back in 1976. And Diane, you are not alone. That is what many administrators are seeing. And so it's more teachers asking questions. And we're going to even talk about this in a few minutes when we talk about what constitutes a discussion. What does that mean, a discussion? And so we see more of that, what Kasdan called the IRE, which is interrogation or inquiry, student response, and then teacher evaluation. And then in guided reading, really expecting students to do it and apply it, often with text that is not really even challenging enough for them to actually need strategies. All right, because the only time what Scott Paris found out and what Paris and Asslerback and David Pearson wrote about in a recent article regarding when do people use comprehension strategies? We use comprehension strategies when we are reading text and are encountering some clunks, or when we're teaching others how to get information from a piece of text. Michelle says, I am processing this with my team right now. So, you know, this is something that, and so this is very timely, and I hope that you will share the webinars that we've already conducted with the teachers that you are also working with so that they can apply some of the ideas in our webinar. So great. So here is Michelle saying that she did observe a conversation today led by the teacher through questioning and helping students to really take advantage of what others are saying and listening in very active ways rather than in just engaging in what we call parallel talk. And we're going to really, again, expand on this today, that we want children to be able to not just be worried about what they are going to say, but to really listen to how others interpreted whatever text they were reading to expand their own comprehension of text. Oh, great question, Michelle. You can access the previous webinars on our RTI, our NYS RTI TAC website, and go into with its professional development, and it says previous, I think it says previous webinars or archived webinars, something like that. But they're all available all the way, not only the most recent two in this webinar series, but we have on this website a wonderful library of webinars on a variety of topics that I think you'll find very useful in the work that you're doing with your teachers at your school. I think we have some wonderful ones, wonderful previous webinars on the relationship between RTI and the Common Core, how that should look in schools. We have some on data and how to conduct data meetings and how to use RTI, how to use data in an RTI infrastructure in a school. And I can't remember of the name of the person who did a wonderful series on early reading, very, very early reading in pre-K, and RTI in pre-K. It was a phenomenal series with information that you don't acquire many places. And so all of these are archived on our website in the professional development, past statewide trainings. Let's move on to our next reflection. So in our last webinar, we were talking about close reading. That was one of the topics, and we didn't take action on the close reading from our past webinar, but we were going to reflect on some things and, again, do those observations. So, for example, when you, and some of you already may know the answer to this, even though you didn't participate, when you, you know, close reading is very trendy right now. And so some of the things that we talked about in our last webinar were what are really effective protocols for close reading and what are ineffective protocols. We talked about the kind of text that is appropriate. And the answer to that was very short text. If you can't fit it on a single page, it's not appropriate for close reading. I mean, the answer was quite simple. And then making sure that, you know, that children have the kind of knowledge. Close reading is always done with very meaty text. And so, therefore, if children are going to be able to make use of the reading that is a high level and challenging text, they need to have that material that they're reading contextualized within thematic units so that they have the essential prior knowledge needed. So we don't want it done, as I've seen in many schools, done in a silo, like it's like practice for the ELA test, or, oh, we need to do ELA, we need to do close reading so I can show you how to do close reading. No, the close reading should be contextualized and in service to deeper thinking about a topic or a piece of writing. And so I had asked you in your observations or in your reflections in your school or in your district, how was the close reading operationalized? And the bigger question, though, is that, you know, close reading is often done with very important primary documents or very inspirational, high-quality literature. So the bigger question is close reading breathing life into reading for kids, or is it simply sucking the life out of the reading because it's overkill? So what are tell me some of the things that after our last webinar you've been thinking about or observing and really putting together for yourself conceptually about close reading? This kind of information, it really needs to percolate. So I'm glad we had a couple of weeks to really percolate on this information and revisit what we're seeing in classrooms and what we're doing ourselves. That's the most powerful kind of learning. Good. I'm seeing lots of responses, and we've had a few more people join us for this sharing. Yes, I agree, Michelle. I think the way, I'm not sure whether I agree that I think the way some of the close reading was implemented at the inception really did suck the life out of reading. And as I said in our last webinar, I said I was working with some schools that actually were reading whole novels, close reading entire novels. And so regardless of how fantastic a novel is, I mean, you know, if you're reading a novel and it takes you 3 months to read it or 2 months to read it because you're going over and, you know, really doing a close reading of every passage, it really does take the life and excitement out of a text. And, you know, so I'm glad to see that desire to really strike a balance to do this. And it certainly can be done with a short piece from a novel, but to really teach kids, this is, as we said last time, this is a kind of reading to analyze a piece of text. It is not a teaching technique. It's a kind of reading to dig more deeply into a type of text or into a rich text that you want children to acquire both insights about author craft, or whether you want them to acquire and discuss some deep ideas and expand those ideas. But children, as we said, they need to have the comprehension strategies. When you're asking kids to do close reading, I think that E.D. Hirsch and David Coleman, the people who are advocating and who created, and I think David Coleman and Pimentel who created the guide for publishers that incorporate lots of close reading, they are people with expertise with college students. They didn't really understand that young children in elementary school need to still have the comprehension strategy instruction that will empower them to come to a close reading experience and be able, that is not the vehicle for teaching strategies. They need to come to that having those strategies already in place. Oh, I love the idea of the differentiation, Diane. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, and doing it, I love that you're talking about, it's not just, it certainly is to be done for, you know, even though it was designed for literary text, and that's typically who is using in college classes, typically these are people in the humanities who are doing close reading to study an author, to analyze a piece of text that they've read for a conversation or for deep study, that it can be used also in social studies and content areas if we adapt it to the knowledge-building discourse of that discipline. It's teaching kids to read like a historian. We don't want to transfer the literary standards for knowledge building to history, because historians have their own discourse, capital D. They have their own protocols for building knowledge, and we need to use the get kids to think and read and talk like historians when we're dealing with historical documents. We need to get kids, when they're reading scientific documents, scientific journal articles, we need to get them to talk like scientists, using the same protocol and standards for evidence that a scientist would use in the close reading experience. Good conversation to reiterate and refine some of that knowledge. Great. Now, questioning. This was our third area that we covered last week. So often I think teachers, you know, have too much to do and too little time to do it. So we often will ask questions off the top of our head. However, what is really important with the little amount of time that we have with our students, and even in the middle school setting, I would say, where it's even a more constrained time, do the teachers in your school deliberately craft questions in advance and have them scripted? Because it's really a picking apart process. There are lots of good questions to ask about a piece of text, but we need to really figure out, how can I use my language to really get at the heart of the takeaway from this piece of text in a way that is truly crafted? And what questions do I need to do away with so I can really ask and spend time discussing, say, the three most important questions? The other thing that all researchers have found from pre-K and kindergarten, people like Catherine Nelson, people like Beck and McCowan, all the way up to high school, Nystrand and Appleby, they have found that it's the follow-up question. We ask a preliminary question to students, but it's the follow-up that, from truly listening to our student, instead of thinking about the next question we're going to ask, our follow-up questions. Are teachers truly having conversations with kids? And this is a very nice segue into our work that we're going to be doing today with what constitutes a discussion, what constitutes a good teacher-led discussion. Are teachers asking follow-up questions that take the comprehension to the higher level? Or are they so busy thinking about their own questions that they're not really listening to kids? What did you find out when you were thinking about this as you did some walkthroughs in classrooms or planned your own lessons? Oh, dear. Yeah, that's what I expected. I mean, I always am optimistic that we are, you know, because questioning has been around for a long time, and we really do know the value of it. But I do think that we often do find teachers at all levels engaging in that IRE, inquiry, child response, and then teacher evaluation. And teachers often, I mean, my students actually laugh at me. They really do. When I say, oh, you know, you need to script this out, and these are novices, you need to write these out, they are very accustomed to just picking a book off a shelf and just generating questions off the top of their head, or haphazardly, if they do have a teacher's manual, haphazardly selecting those questions rather than really valuing the little bit of time that they have and being more selective and deliberate in the question selection process. I think it really is a challenge in our classrooms, and that and using some of the things like Michelle that you're bringing up, Bloom's taxonomy, I think you'll love, Michelle, you will really enjoy some of the accessory materials that are in the folder from our presentation last week. I included a wonderful article called The Skyscraper Technique that helps teachers. It's really designed to help kids ask good questions, but it's a very nice protocol for doing exactly what you're suggesting, is getting teachers to use the old Bloom's taxonomy to be deliberate in asking higher level questions. I think you'll really find that skyscraper article very useful that's in that folder from last week. Okay, so now we're moving in. Oh, I'm just going to add one word, Michelle, that, you know, we found a research project that I did with David Pearson, Barbara Taylor, and Georgia Garcia. We found that question generation by students was the very most difficult strategy for children. Not summarizing, not so much key ideas and ideational prominence, but it was that getting kids to ask the high-level, thick, juicy questions that get to the higher levels of thinking. And what Brock Rosenshine has found is that using question stems is the best way to get students to do that. So we addressed that in that last webinar. So I think you'll find that last webinar very helpful. So the importance of talking, I mean, this is a nice segue of the, because, you know, the questions that teachers ask are what facilitate a good or not so good conversation about text. And so the role of communication when we talk about comprehension is utmost in priority, because it refines and expands comprehension both individually and as a community member, all right? Because when we are communicating, it forces us to integrate what we've read with our original ideas. All right, that integration of what our prior knowledge is and the new information that we're exposed to in text, it, by having to communicate the ideas, forces us to integrate it. It forces us to organize it in a new way and to prune what is less important, less valuable, or no longer relevant. And so the communication is where it all is. The other thing is, sharing serves as the artifact of understanding and also to expand the comprehension of others. It's what we say, it's what we write that is going to not only express what's inside our head and not visible, because we can't do an MRI on all of our students to see whether they're comprehending or not. We rely on their communication through oral communication and through written communication. And so, therefore, it serves as an artifact of the understanding and to also expand the comprehension of others by getting and sharing the ideas and what we took away from a piece of text. It's inseparable from comprehension. It's inseparable. And therefore, the instruction that's happening in classrooms has to explicitly address talk and writing as an essential part of comprehension instruction. And this is important. Talk is often the rehearsal for the writing. And if we're not having enough student talk, you're going to see difficulties with student written expression. They have to have time to talk about the ideas before they're held accountable to write them. So, we do have, converging evidence that talks about the important dimensions of a student-led conversation at all levels and all grade levels. And even though we today are focusing on grades 3 through 6, these things are really go from pre-K through college and beyond, all right? Things like authenticity. are we asking questions that we as teachers really need to listen to kids to give the answer to? Yes, we do need to do some literal questions to ensure that there is the foundational understanding, but we should be able to get through those questions in our discussion fairly quickly. And then have a few questions, and this is why that crafting becomes so important and why the pre-planning and scripting is important, because we need to have a balance of the low-level questions, you know, several low-level questions, and then a hand, one or two high-level questions that will be authentic and will really expand and extend the thinking. The uptake, that's the follow-up question. The teacher has got to be present to really be listening to what the kids are saying in response to her preliminary questions or questions generated by other students. And then there have to be follow-up questions based on what the what other children are saying that the teacher didn't have scripted. If she's only looking at the script in her teacher's guide, or if she's trying to think of the next question and what she's going to say next, she can't be cognitively present to ask the high-level and crafted follow-up question. All right? The other thing is level of evaluation. We want there to be questions, and in part of this discussion format, for children to be responding in authentic ways and having to support their answers, all right, without the fear of constant right or wrong evaluation. There have to be open-ended questions where there are multiple directions to go in. Also, the discussion, again, it needs to have that thematic curricular connection. This is one of the challenges. If everybody in this class is reading a different book, it's typically not connected to the curriculum that enables you get to doing deeper and deeper knowledge building or deeper and deeper questioning. We really want to have what the kids are reading embedded in grades 3 through 6. It needs to be embedded in curriculum. I always like to say that by grades 3 through 6, it shouldn't be reading period. It should look more, those of you who are doing walk-ins, it should look more like when you walk in at 9 o'clock in the morning, it should look more like a science lab, or it should look more like a newspaper place, or it should look more like a historical museum where people are doing research and people are reading and writing and talking in the discipline for authentic purposes. And it should always have high academic demands. Types of talk. So the types of talk that we're likely to have teachers and kids generating is talk about the book or talk about the passage, or talking about the reading process itself. What are they thinking about? How do you engage in the reading process? As I said, some aspects are the same by discipline, but others are different in the service to knowledge building. And so how do these processes, what is the process we're using when we are reading this scientific journal or this scientific passage about different kinds of plants, let's say, or endangered species? Talking about connections to prior knowledge and what we do with those connections to other texts that we've read, because in historical reading and in scientific reading, a piece of text doesn't stand alone. We can't validate it without comparing it to converging evidence. It is meaningless when it stands alone. And so it's important to talk about, when we're reading historical and science passages, what do other authors and what's other research say? And talking about the group process for forming knowledge. Now, we have a couple different kinds of literature circles. So we would have, if we're having small groups of kids reading literary text in something like what we would call a literature circle and a book club. This is very popular in these grades. Some of the things that research has found is essential are things like student choice is imperative. It can be controlled choice, but there needs to be some choice, rich literature, and multiple forms of response. Response talking, response writing. How do we begin? Now, I often hear teachers in schools that I work with say, well, that can work with their classes, but oh, if you ever saw my class, you know this doesn't work. Well, what we know in research is small student-led discussions. Now we've shifted over to student-led discussion. Student-led discussion yields higher-level comprehension, but also it actually yields more respectful classroom settings. And so therefore, what are the steps that we want to teach kids to so that they're capable of having small group discussions? We need to explain, and just like we're talking back again about the gradual release of responsibility, we need to give kids explicit instruction on how to have a small group conversation. We need to demonstrate for our kids how to do it using videos, maybe videos of prior kids doing it, videos that we find on YouTube of children engaging that, and eventually in videos of each other. We also need to engage in practice, all right? Have them practice with us sitting in, all right, sitting into it, and then eventually sitting on the side. There needs to be a debrief period, and then we need it's a dance. It's a dance, as all gradual release of responsibility is. We don't ever get to the end. We're constantly sliding up and down that diagonal. The beginning steps of getting our children to have student-led conversations in require lots of modeling. So, for example, with our kids, we're going to say, how do we handle the person in our group who doesn't shut up? How do we handle the person who is taking more of their fair share time of our group? Let's model it, all right? And doing that role playing. Or what do we do? What are some things that we do to engage the person who never talks in our group or the person that after some of us have taken several terms, we haven't invited them in? How do we invite them in? We also have fishbowl conversations where we have one conversation group on the inside of the circle, another group on the outside. And we can do this. There are many ways to do this, and you can look at YouTube videos. There are lots of YouTube videos of this now. Sometimes they're just doing an analysis after the kids do what went well in the conversation that you observed, what didn't, you know, what could they do better? And having a self-evaluation check sheet that we're going to look at in a minute to look at, so it's very non-personal. It's low inference. Okay, we saw that everyone did participate. Yes, we saw that everyone took their fair share of talk. Yes, we saw people asking their own questions and listening to someone else and asking them about it. And so continuing to engage in the gradual release of responsibility. There are some ways that we can support kids in preparing for discussion. Getting them to put post-it notes on their reading. You know, when they are doing their reading independently to prepare for the discussion, using post-it notes to address questions and thoughts and vocabulary words they don't know, and important ideas and reflections on what they've read, doing that with post-it notes. Or for the less sophisticated kid, you might have response journals where you're actually giving them some questions, much like instructional conversations did. They gave kids prompts, and the kids answered those prompts in their response journals. If it's text that the kids have or like something like a magazine article, they can actually code it, all right, on the side or using Cornell notes, having a double entry journal where they write what the text said and then what they think about it. All of these are good ways to do this. Or something like a bookmark where you have the kids fold a paper in thirds. Each section of the bookmark, the student records one form of response. Maybe they maybe questions, or maybe interesting facts, or maybe new vocabulary, or summarizing at certain points. And they do this on their bookmark. This is huge. Those roles that people assign, that should only be used as a temporary cognitive scaffold. We should not be seeing fifth graders still using roles. All right, especially if we have a school that encourages student-led discussions from, say, second grade and beyond. Those roles are a temporary scaffold. The maximum should be 3 or 4 weeks. The value of assigning somebody a role is it gives the child the cognitive perspective of what they should be doing and thinking about when they are reading on their own independently at their desk, and what they should bring back to their group. But the goal is always for students, like our strategies, it's always to apply that cognitive perspective flexibly in response to the text and the context. So these are some of the temporary roles people assign in literature circles to get kids thinking in those kinds of cognitive perspectives. Discussion director, somebody to serve sort of as a gatekeeper. Word wizard, somebody who's going to bring some of the more difficult vocabulary words to the group. A connector, let's connect this with our other texts that we've read or connect it to our real lives. A summarizer, somebody who's going to synthesize and summarize the information that was read for the day. An illustrator, that should not always be a child who has decoding difficulties, folks. Too often I see people say, oh, well, you know, yes, I get all of my children to participate, and I let the children who are reading at a lower level be the illustrator. We certainly want a universal design, but the goal is for everybody to have to practice all the roles and to have a turn at all the roles, so that then after about 2 to 3 weeks, they can be reading and implementing all of these cognitive jobs as needed, flexibly. Some roles for discovery circles, or when kids are reading informational text, because we still want kids to be working in groups with informational text, because informational text is among the most difficult, and that they really need collaborative discussion about these texts. So things would be the connector, how does this connect to our other prior knowledge, and the hands-on activities that we may be doing in class. The questioner, this is going to generate, the person who's going to generate some good questions or questions to go beyond the text. Passage master, who is going to really talk about the big ideas. The summarizer, word wizard, researcher, who may bring in some other sources of information about this topic, and an illustrator, same thing. It is important when we are instructing kids for us to do some mini lessons. And the mini lesson topics that we're going to share with kids on how to have good conversations is likely to be content-based around things like artist craft, theme, identifying the themes, strategy application, or applying disciplinary knowledge appropriately to informational text. So we might be teaching kids in their mini lesson how to do this, or we might be teaching them actual procedures of how to have a small group conversation, sharing airtime. We want kids to have a range of opinions and insights based on text, but how do we disagree constructively? Self-assessment and gatekeeping. And we do want to, if these are really an authentic and important part of our instruction, then we are going to assess how our children do in these independent learning contexts. And so some of the ways we can do that is, the simplest way is probably just have an end of book log collection where you look at all their response logs and evaluate it in some form. Or another simple way, which is not very evaluative, is either they were prepared with what you asked them to do or they were not prepared. They either participated or they did not participate. And what is essential, however, are student self-assessments. And, this is a teacher assessment. Did the kids come prepared? Were they active listeners? Did they share responsibility? Did they ask follow-up questions? Did they use text to support their positions? And did they do record keeping? And so these points add up to 100. And so this would be a very formal kind of regimented way to evaluate a small book club or reading circle. But the self-assessment would be more like a Likert scale or a check sheet, all right, using checks and comments. And the kids would actually do this and evaluate themselves, all right? And so we actually use this in that work that I did with David Pearson, Barbara Taylor, and Joey Garcia. We use this with classrooms in second through fifth grade. And it was, how did we interact with the text? Working together to understand, use of strategies that they had actually been explicitly taught, and did they do rereading as part of the conversation? Did they pull out ideas from the text to support their claims? And then also evaluation related to interacting with each other. Are they asking each other questions, taking turns talking, listening actively, and responding to each other and being respectful of each other? And here, you know, and so it actually, each child got a self-assessment that looked something like this. And so they would actually evaluate themselves and the members of their group, giving them either a check or check plus, and then having to use the chart above to identify, they used strategies, they reread when they were discussing it, or they got a check plus because they asked other people questions and were respectfully disagreeing with someone. And so the children then, that gets them really involved with the components of what makes for a good discussion, because they're evaluating themselves and others. And this is also the same evaluation sheet that the classrooms used, that the teachers used when they were looking at videos of real live conversations. They modeled for kids how to use this check sheet in a very low inference way to make judgments about what makes for a good conversation or not. And here you see some charts from these classrooms. Now, when we look at the findings related to that particular study by Joey Garcia, David Pearson, Barbara Taylor, Yuri Bauer, myself, and in these articles that you can dig more deeply into, is first of all classrooms use some form of student support or a cheat sheet during that transitional stage. Those things like bookmarks, those things like the self-evaluations that they used to sort of keep them on track. The largest shifts were seen in a classroom that used videos and self-evaluations in tandem over time. Younger students, the second graders, simply needed more time and more support to take ownership of the student-led conversations. But student-led groups started sooner when the expectation and support were in place. Here's what teachers themselves said about it. Oh, they said, student choice matters, not only in what text they're reading, but also in who the members of their group are and what groups they're participating in. Also, texts need to be complex and interesting to the students. They need to figure out the balancing level of teacher engagement. How engaged should you be? You've got to let go of control. You've got to be there first being a part of to sort of guide the conversation, but then sitting on the side and letting the students take over responsibility. And it was, again, ongoing. This article by Beth Malock is one of my very favorite all-time articles. She talks in this article about a teacher who worked with children in her classroom who were special ed kids, who were children who had low reading levels, and who had behavior problems, were EBD kids. And what were the secrets of getting these kids to successfully participate and be honored and accepted in book clubs and literature circles? And here is what she found. The teacher has to monitor the group dynamics. She has to provide scaffolding as needed. And the teacher is the one who sets the tone for modeling acceptance and inclusion of all voices. And I'm going to tell you, one of the things that is the thing that it can really be damaging to allowing all voices to be heard in a book club is if you have one of those red light, yellow light, green light things in a classroom in which all children publicly see who's on a red light. That is one of the quickest ways to garnishing disrespect for children in the class. And so what we want is for all children to be respected and to have a strong voice and for their voice to be honored in their discussion. The academic demands, there has to be a range, and teachers need to provide some support for kids that might have lower levels of reading. Remember, the function of this is comprehension. So if kids need to, for these books, either read it with a partner or listen to a tape, that's fine, because they may need different access points into the text. But the function of this is thinking and comprehension and talking. And so that's what we want to keep our focus on as teachers, is what's the purpose? Providing text choices, provide reading choices. Don't say, oh, you're at level L, so you have to read a level K or L book. You know, we want to give children choices, and we don't want to limit the amount of growth a child can make because we're locking them into a low-level text. They will never bridge the gap. And using a variety, we don't always want to have book clubs, and we don't always want to have student choice in book clubs, but we want to really mix it up. Comprehension staples for beginners, both teachers and students, that start this conversation happening in a formulaic kind of way. Things like the directed reading thinking activity and reciprocal teaching. The more sophisticated, as our teachers get more confident in leading high-level discussions, things like questioning the author, instructional conversations, collaborative reasoning, and concept-oriented reading instruction. These studies that I have listed here are old because they are the seminal research, but there has been research done on every one of these techniques over the last 20 years that makes each of these four of the six techniques extremely robust. They've been tested over and over in various settings. And these are the articles that you can look up for the first steps, but I encourage you to Google these techniques because these are very robust conversational techniques that give teachers some direction. Writing in response to text. In writing in response to text, we do want kids to do various kinds of writing. We want them answering questions. We want them taking notes. In order to take notes, you've got to be able to know what's most to least important, what I call ideational prominence. You've got to know what's most to least important. Summarizing, synthesizing more than one document, that is a very hard task. And even now in third, fourth, fifth grade, we want to explicitly provide opportunities for kids to synthesize more than one document. Building new knowledge, doing research projects, evaluating and critiquing, creating arguments, which is different than supporting opinions. In our ELA Common Core, we often hear about supporting an opinion, whereas in science, the new science standards are asking kids to create arguments and then other purposeful writing activities. Again, we want to apply the gradual release of responsibility. This is just good learning and good teaching. Explicit instruction and use of anchor texts. Then teacher modeling, all right? Modeling on chart paper, modeling on an overhead and on our smart boards. Then using the whole class to share the writing experiences. These three steps should be done before we ever ask a kid to write something by him or herself. There should be, if I walk into a class and see that kids are writing something, I should be able to see, when I look around the room, I should see at least three or four models of it. If I don't, then I worry that a kid wasn't really taught. I worry that a kid was asked to do something before he really knew what the task was. Then guided writing with small group compositions and feedback, direct feedback to the child before that final stage of saying, write about XYZ in this particular format. I think we don't do enough in explicit instruction with children in regard to writing. We just cross our fingers and hope they can do it. We also need to situate writing within disciplinary knowledge building. And you have an article that explains this in much more detail. Because what counts as evidence? When we ask kids, give two pieces of evidence from the article. Well, evidence in science is different than evidence with literary text. Teachers need to teach kids exactly what the evidence is that counts as knowledge building. And so in literary text, these are what children should be writing about and including in any of the writing that they're doing. But when they're writing about social studies topics and in response to historical documents, this is what they should be extracting and using in their writing. I rarely see teachers teaching this to kids. And so, therefore, we have kids often looking at one piece of paper or one passage and making judgments and building arguments that are flawed arguments. Anybody can pluck. Anybody can go into a passage and pluck something out. But that is not comprehension, and that is not knowledge building in each of these fields, which is the purpose for reading and writing. And the article in your package for today, What Counts as Evidence, really elaborates on this with information from each of the disciplines. We also want to have cohesiveness between reading and writing. And again, you saw me mention some of these sources in reading. And these are important sources because they also translate into writing and involve writing. It's not separate. Even in our close reading, there needs to be individual responses written by students following the discussions. And for students who really will benefit from explicitness, all I can say is Graham and Harris, Graham and Harris, Graham and Harris. These folks, to me, their research on powerful writing strategies have been around for the last 20 years. And again, I don't see this in a lot of the classrooms I'm working in. Their work began. This book is a wonderful resource, and it's for classroom teachers. It's very teacher-friendly. It gives actual lessons that teachers can implement in their classrooms. And Graham and Harris, if you look around during summers and from some of the BOCES places, they offer self-regulated strategy development training sessions. And I know that some of the districts that I've worked with, I know Williamsville and I believe Orchard Park has actually sent some of their teachers to training sessions to do some of this kind of writing instruction. And it is very powerful, and it really can make a difference in a school's writing program. And it's this began with children. Their work began in special education, helping children self-regulate and to know what needed certain steps to get something down on paper in response to something they had read. But then classroom teachers began to see how effective it was. And so then Graham and Harris began implementing it in general education classrooms and also extending their research to general ed classrooms. And it hands down works, works, works. It not only promotes improvement in writing and the composition process, but it also promotes development of positive attitudes about writing and about kids themselves as writers. And so now we'll close, just like we talked about the need to assess conversation groups and discussion, you also want to have some consistent tools that you're using to assess student writing. I happen to like, as well, I think that the ELA Engage New York also refers classrooms and teachers to the 6+1 traits rubrics, which are very detailed and are wonderful for using 3 to 4 times a year to inform your instruction, all right? But then for shorter writing tasks, you can use and help your students use to self-assess and to self-evaluate, use the rubrics that are used by the state ELA test. And I would also use that as part of your common formative assessments after each unit of study, whether it's a literary unit, a science unit, or a social studies unit, and giving children a couple short constructed responses to do and then one extended response and using the ELA rubric so that you really are progress monitoring without teaching for the test in an artificial way. So questions, I know we really rushed through that last bit, but you know, that's an area for you to dig into more deeply. I want to thank you. We have time now. You can be typing some questions that you might have about conversation and writing in response to comprehension. You can be typing in some questions or your thoughts. I want to thank all of you for participating in the last 3 webinars. It has really been a delight to see your names recurring over and over again and to have these opportunities to do the work that we're doing in sustained ways. I love that we've been able to do it as a carry-on and to see how you've applied some of what we've talked about. And I encourage you to join us on our next series, the next series is my absolute passion, comprehension in pre-K or K through 2. But I hope that you'll join us for that because it's going to be entirely different. It's not going to be just some of the same old, same old. It's really quite different for the babies. And I hope that I will see some of your names for the next webinar series that begins next week for comprehension in the primary grades. And please bring along some of your teacher friends that are teaching in those grade levels. So I'm not seeing anyone typing any questions or comments. I'm getting some buzzing on my phone. Am I still on? Molly, am I still even? I must be, otherwise I guess I would have heard something from you. Any questions, comments about our series? Oh, good. I like to hear you. Otherwise, I am afraid that I've gotten disconnected.
Okay, we lost audio for a minute there, so I don't know if you were looking for us.
Did you lose me? I mean, have I always been on there? Or?
You're on. You're good. It's just us. Our battery died in the office, so.
Okay.
Yeah, but I see that a couple people are typing, so we'll let that go. Thank you for plugging the pre-K to 2. We hope you folks will join us.
Okay, great. Thank you all for your feedback. Thank you all for your feedback. As I said, otherwise, if I'm here, I'm afraid, especially because I had two buzzes on my phone today and that I've never had before, and I'm there, can they still hear me? Am I still connected? I like to have you chatting with me.
Good. And Michelle's telling us that she can hear. So that's wonderful. Thank you, Michelle, for chiming in. It doesn't look like we have any questions today. So we'll give it a second here, but a very, very thorough presentation as always, and lots of great information.
Hope you will join us for the early comprehension. As I said, that is really my first love. Oh,
I can't wait.
Excited to be able to share that with you and with some of your friends that are in those grade levels.
All right, well, it looks like we are good, so I would like to thank you for the presentation today, and I hope everybody has a wonderful night. And Dr. Stahl, if you just hang on for a second, I'd appreciate that.
Thank
we'll
you,
end
Molly.
The recording.
Thank you, Dane.
Thank you. Okay. All right. I guess we are good to go. So we have, and I'm on with you next week, Kay. So,
oh, great.
You can email me the presentation and we'll connect as usual.
Okay. Well, how did you receive this presentation? You know, I don't know why I had so many problems. I found that if I go and just start sending an email, then there's a bottom, an icon at the bottom, and it says share this. How did you actually end up receiving the presentation?
I did get the Google link, but I also got it in my email.
Okay.
So I got it two ways. Did you get both, Dane? Did you get the Google link and the... Yeah, he got both as well. So either one, whatever is easiest for you.
I think I finally figured it out. I think if I just do it with the link, with the icon at the bottom, it shares.
Okay. Yeah, so. I can go back and look if you wanted me to, but I think both were there and I can get to both, so...
Okay. Well, so good. We ended up with like what?